On a late summer afternoon in August 2017, 22-year-old Savannah, LaFontaine Graywind, expecting her first child, stepped out of her Fargo apartment to help her upstairs neighbor with a sewing project. No one noticed her leave. Hours passed. Concern turned to terror when her family realized she'd vanished. 8 days later, a grisly discovery: Savannah's body, bound in plastic, found floating in the Red River. Her newborn daughter had been cut from her womb and kept alive. In the small Midwestern city, horror turned to outrage. How could a pregnant woman be lured upstairs under a seemingly innocent pretext? And how did her unborn baby survive such savagery? The case would expose deep failures in the protection of Indigenous women and propel a nationwide movement for change. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1: The Calm Before the Nightmare. The apartment complex sat on the corner of 4th Street North in Fargo, North Dakota. Modest, quiet, and mostly filled with working families, it was the kind of place where people nodded to each other in the hallway and smiled without stopping to talk. In apartment 5, Savannah LaFontaine Graywind lived with her parents and younger brother. At 22, she was radiant with the glow of new life. 8 months pregnant, she had already picked a name for the daughter she was carrying, Hazley Joe. Savannah wasn't just any young woman. She was part of the Spirit Lake Nation, a proud and enduring Indigenous community in North Dakota. Her family described her as nurturing, soft-spoken, and loyal. She worked as a certified nursing assistant and had plans to become a registered nurse. More than anything, Savannah wanted to be a good mother. Her boyfriend, Ashton Matheny, had moved into the apartment to prepare for their new life as parents. They were young, but grounded. It was Saturday, August 19th, 2017, when everything changed. Savannah had just returned home from a shift at the local hospital. She kicked off her shoes and stretched her aching feet. She was in her third trimester, and her body reminded her of it every time she moved. As she sat down to eat, there was a knock at the door. Her mother, Norberta, answered. Standing in the hallway was a woman from upstairs, Brooke Cruz. She lived in apartment 7 with her boyfriend, William Hone. Brooke looked disheveled but friendly. She said she was working on a sewing project and asked if Savannah could help her pin a dress she was altering. It seemed odd but harmless. Savannah looked at her mom. Norberta hesitated, then nodded. "I'll be right back," Savannah said. Those would be the last words her family ever heard from her. When 30 minutes passed, Norberta noticed the time. She began pacing. Another 30 minutes turned into an hour, then two. She knocked on Brooke's door, no answer. She knocked again, nothing. By nightfall, anxiety gripped the entire apartment. Ashton was calling friends. Her father was checking the parking lot. Norberta kept calling Savannah's phone, which rang until it went to voicemail. By 4 p.m., they called the Fargo Police Department. Officers arrived, took down the information, and began canvassing the building. They knocked on all the doors. When they reached Brooke and William's apartment, the couple insisted Savannah had come up but left shortly after. "Nothing suspicious," they said. They even invited officers inside to look around. It seemed cooperative, but something was wrong, and everyone in Savannah's family could feel it. The next day, the search intensified. Flyers went up across Fargo. Volunteers gathered in small groups to comb through streets, alleys, riverbanks. Norberta gave media interviews, pleading through tears. Ashton refused to sleep, working day and night with friends to distribute flyers and follow any lead, no matter how vague. Still, no sign of Savannah. Then came the tip. A neighbor reported seeing Brooke Cruz carrying what looked like a newborn baby in the days after Savannah vanished. But how? Brooke was never pregnant. Police re-entered the apartment building, this time with a warrant. On August 24th, they burst through the door of apartment 7. What they found would haunt every officer for the rest of their careers. There, in a makeshift crib, was a baby girl, alive, crying, swaddled in a blanket. Brooke claimed the child was hers, but she refused a medical exam. DNA testing was ordered immediately. And 3 days later, on August 27th, 8 days after Savannah disappeared, a kayaker on the Red River made a grim discovery. It was early morning. The water was calm. The man noticed a plastic bag floating near the edge of the riverbank. It was weighted down with rocks, partially submerged. When he opened it, he recoiled. Inside was the body of a young woman, wrapped in duct tape and rope. She was barefoot. Her hair floated in the water like a black halo. Her abdomen bore a long incision. The autopsy confirmed what investigators feared. It was Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. She had been murdered. Her baby had been forcibly removed from her womb. And somehow, miraculously, the child had survived. The press descended on Fargo. The public was stunned. How could a woman so close to full term be murdered in broad daylight, inside an apartment complex, and go unnoticed? And how could her baby be kept alive by the very people who killed her? Fargo had never seen a case like it. Police re-interviewed Brooke Cruz and William Hone. Under pressure, Brooke finally cracked. She admitted the truth. She had lured Savannah to the apartment with the sewing request. Once inside, she attacked her, knocked her unconscious. She and William then tied her up. When Savannah woke, they told her they were taking her baby. Brooke performed the crude cesarean herself using tools from their kitchen. Savannah bled to death on the floor. They had hidden her body in a dresser for days before dumping it in the river. In the meantime, they cared for the baby like she was their own. William denied involvement in the killing. He claimed he helped clean up, but didn't participate in the murder. Brooke insisted it was a joint decision. Neither version made it easier to swallow. For Savannah's family, the pain was almost unbearable. Norberta wept as she held her granddaughter for the first time. The baby, named Hazley Joe, was returned to Ashton. She was small but healthy. The media continued to swarm. National attention turned to a long-ignored issue, the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women in North America. Savannah's case, because of its shocking nature and undeniable injustice, became a rallying cry. It exposed the vulnerability of Indigenous women to violence and the institutional gaps in protecting them. Within a year, a bill was introduced in Congress. Savannah's Act, designed to improve tribal access to federal databases and better track cases of missing Native women. The law wouldn't bring Savannah back, but it might save others. As the city mourned and tribal leaders spoke out, one detail haunted everyone. If a young, pregnant woman could vanish in the middle of the day, surrounded by neighbors, law enforcement, and her own family, how many others had disappeared without a trace? And how many of their stories had been ignored? In the silence left by Savannah's absence, a movement began, and justice, though slow, was on its way. Chapter 2, The Baby in the Crib. The moment officers stepped into apartment 7, the atmosphere changed. It wasn't just the clutter or the faint odor of antiseptic and something sour. It was the silence, the kind that presses against your chest. And then came the sound, a baby's cry, sharp, unmistakable, and entirely out of place. Sergeant Joseph Anderson was the first to spot the bassinet, pushed against the far wall of the living room. Inside, wrapped in a powder blue blanket with tiny ducks stitched along the edge, was a newborn girl. Her cheeks were flushed. Her eyes fluttered open for a moment, then closed again, exhausted. Brooke Cruz hovered beside the crib, her face pale and strained. Her hands trembled slightly, as if she wasn't sure whether to protect the child or shield herself. "Whose baby is this?" the officer asked. "She's mine," Brooke said quickly. "Too quickly." "You were never pregnant," the officer replied. Brooke hesitated. "It was a secret pregnancy. I didn't tell anyone." No one in the building had seen her gain weight. No maternity clothes. No signs. She had simply emerged with a baby in her arms after Savannah vanished. The officers didn't buy it, but protocol required restraint. They didn't have enough to arrest her that moment. Not yet. So they documented everything. The child was taken into protective custody. She was rushed to the hospital for examination. Police filed an emergency petition for DNA testing. What they didn't know, yet, was that the child had been born not in a hospital, but in the dim, blood-stained bathroom of that same apartment. While officers tried to piece together the truth, Savannah's parents waited by the phone. Norberta sat with her back against the kitchen wall, clutching a photo of Savannah from high school. Ashton paced the hallway, every footstep fueled by panic and adrenaline. He refused to eat, barely spoke. He just kept whispering her name, like a prayer he didn't know how to finish. When they received the call about the baby, time seemed to freeze. The nurse on the line explained that a newborn had been found alive in Brooke Cruz's apartment. She wouldn't say much, only that the infant was in good condition, stable, breathing on her own. And then came the question no parent should ever be asked. Would they come in for a DNA test? The hospital room was bright, sterile, and almost too quiet. Norberta's breath hitched as she looked down at the child. The nurse gently placed the tiny girl into her arms. She was warm, her skin soft as rose petals. Savannah's eyes, Norberta whispered. She has Savannah's eyes. Ashton stood beside them, his hands shaking. He didn't cry, not then, but something inside him broke open. He touched the baby's hand, and her fingers curled around his pinky. He whispered, hazily, "My baby girl." The DNA tests would take a few days, but everyone in that room already knew the truth. At the police department, the walls were closing in on Brooke Cruz and William Hone. Detectives returned to the apartment with a search warrant. Inside, they found bloodstains on the bathroom floor, towels soaked through, kitchen shears, zip ties, a roll of black duct tape. Behind a dresser drawer, they discovered a plastic tote, empty but reeking of bleach and decay. What they didn't find was Savannah. Not yet, but they were close. When the DNA results came back, they confirmed what everyone feared. The baby was Savannah's, and she hadn't been delivered in a hospital. She had been taken, by force. On August 27th, 8 days after Savannah's disappearance, a kayaker on the Red River made a call to 911. "There's a plastic bag floating near the shore," he said. "I think there's something inside." When officers arrived, they waded through the water and pulled the bag ashore. What they found was a human body, female, bound, wrapped in layers of duct tape and plastic, weighted down with rocks. The medical examiner later confirmed it was Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. The autopsy revealed deep bruising, defensive wounds, and the crude incision that marked the removal of her unborn child. She had bled to death slowly. Her body had been dumped like garbage. Back at the station, detectives brought Brooke in for questioning again. This time, the tone was different. "You killed her," the investigator said flatly. Brooke looked down. "I didn't mean to. I just wanted the baby." And then it all came spilling out. She said she'd been jealous. She wanted a child, but couldn't conceive. When she saw Savannah's pregnancy, an idea took root. Delusional. Obsessive. She lured Savannah to the apartment with the promise of a sewing project. She'd even pre-cut fabric and laid out scissors, pretending to alter a dress. Once Savannah stepped inside, she attacked her. William helped restrain her. Then, while Savannah was tied up, Brooke sliced open her abdomen. She said Savannah was alive through part of it. She said she begged. She said she screamed. When it was over, she cleaned the baby and held her like a prize. William helped clean up the mess. They stuffed Savannah's body in a tote and hid it in the closet for days before dumping it into the river. It wasn't just a crime, it was a horror story come to life. William Hone denied participating in the murder. He admitted helping dispose of the body and trying to cover up the evidence, but insisted he didn't know what Brooke planned. No one believed him. But in court, it would be enough to complicate everything. For the family, those legal games meant nothing. What mattered was this: their daughter was gone. But her baby, her legacy, had survived. Hazley Joe became the center of the storm. Reporters camped outside the hospital. News anchors used her name in headlines. But in her grandfather's arms, she was just a baby. Innocent. Unaware of the nightmare she had survived. In the Spirit Lake Nation and across Indian country, Savannah's death reignited an old wound. It was a tragic reminder of how often Indigenous women are taken, silenced, erased, and forgotten. But not this time. Savannah's name would be remembered. It would echo in courtrooms, on protest signs, and in the halls of Congress. And the baby who lived would carry that story forward. Chapter 3, Savannah's Act. The courtroom was silent as Brooke Cruz entered in shackles, her face drained of emotion. The press called her the Womb Raider. But in the eyes of Savannah's family, no nickname could capture what had been taken from them. Her parents sat in the front row, Norberta clutching a tissue so tightly it tore in her hand. Ashton, holding baby Hazley in his arms, stared forward with a hollow look, as if every ounce of grief had been burned into his skin. The courtroom drama was more than a trial. It was a reckoning. Brooke pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit kidnapping, conspiracy to commit murder, and lying to law enforcement. She showed little remorse, and when asked why she did it, she gave a chilling reply. "I wanted a family. I thought it would fix everything." Judge Frank Rochek didn't flinch. "You didn't just take a life," he said. "You took a mother from her child, a daughter from her family, and shattered a community." He sentenced Brooke Cruz to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But the legal system wasn't done yet. William Hone's trial would be different. He pled not guilty to conspiracy to commit murder. He claimed he had no idea Brooke planned to kill Savannah. His defense painted him as complicit in the cover-up, but not in the killing. The evidence was damning but unclear. He admitted to helping bind Savannah, admitted to seeing the blood, admitted to helping clean the apartment and hide her body, but insisted he thought Savannah was dead when he found her. The jury was split. They acquitted him of murder, but found him guilty of kidnapping and providing false information to investigators. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. It wasn't justice in full, but it was something. And for Savannah's family, it was one step forward. In the aftermath, something unexpected happened. Savannah's story lit a fire far beyond North Dakota. Indigenous activists had long warned about the epidemic of missing and murdered Native women. But Savannah's name, her face, her baby, it struck a nerve. Her story wasn't just sad. It was infuriating. Why did it take such a brutal, public tragedy for the world to care? Senator Heidi Heitkamp, moved by the case and the outrage that followed, introduced a bill in Savannah's name, Savannah's Act. Its purpose was clear: to bridge the gap between tribal communities and federal law enforcement. Too often, cases involving Native women were lost in bureaucratic limbo, jurisdictional confusion, lack of resources, poor communication. Savannah's Act would require the Department of Justice to develop protocols for handling cases of missing and murdered Indigenous people, improved training for law enforcement, standardized data collection, greater accountability. It was a bold, necessary move, but it didn't pass in 2018. The bill stalled. Politics got in the way. It took two more years and growing pressure from tribal leaders, families, and social justice organizations for Congress to finally act. In October 2020, President Donald Trump signed Savannah's Act into law. By then, Hazley Joe was 3 years old. She didn't know the weight her name carried. She didn't understand why strangers said her mother was a symbol, why reporters still called, why people cried when they saw her in public. She only knew her family loved her. She only knew her mother through photographs and the stories whispered to her before bed. The signing of the bill was both triumphant and bittersweet. Norberta, standing before a small crowd of tribal families and legislators, held up a photo of her daughter. "She should be here to see this," she said, her voice shaking. "But maybe this way, she's still helping others. Maybe she's still saving lives." The cameras clicked. Reporters took notes. But behind the lens, the pain still pulsed. Savannah's Act was progress. It was a promise to do better. But it wasn't enough. It couldn't bring her back. And it couldn't fix what had already been broken. Across the United States, similar cases continued to surface. Missing Indigenous girls. Unsolved murders. Families still waiting for answers. Savannah's case may have changed the law, but the system was still flawed. Tribal jurisdictions often lacked the authority to prosecute non-Native offenders. Law enforcement agencies still failed to share information effectively. And too many Indigenous families still buried their daughters with no justice, no headlines, and no names written into law. But Savannah's legacy had planted something deeper. A voice, a movement, and a refusal to be silent again. Savannah's family became vocal advocates. Norberta spoke at conferences. Ashton, though private, occasionally allowed interviews, always on his own terms, always focused on Hazley Joe. The girl became a living reminder of survival. She had been born in the darkest circumstances imaginable, but she had lived, thrived, and her life meant something, not just to her family, to an entire nation of people who finally saw themselves reflected in the fight for justice. Chapter 4, The Silence Between the Headlines. When the cameras left Fargo, when the courtroom lights dimmed and reporters packed up their microphones, silence returned. But it wasn't peace. It was the hollow quiet of unfinished grief. Norberta LaFontaine Graywind still kept Savannah's room exactly as it had been. The folded baby clothes Savannah bought, still sealed in plastic. Her name stitched on a white hospital bag. The books she would never get to read to her daughter. There were days when Norberta sat in that room and just listened. Listened for something that could never come back. People thought justice was closure. It wasn't. The trials had ended. The law had changed. But the wound remained. Not just for Savannah's family, but for thousands of others who had lost loved ones in the shadows. Missing women whose names were never printed on protest signs or passed as legislation. In Indian country, the silence wasn't new. It had always been there. What made Savannah different? Was it the brutality? The timing? Or the baby? Whatever it was, her case had cracked something open. And for many families, that light felt both welcome and cruel. In the years before Savannah's murder, Native American women faced some of the highest rates of violence in the country. A Department of Justice study estimated that more than 4 out of 5 Native women experienced violence in their lifetime. More than half had encountered sexual violence. Many cases went unreported, uninvestigated, unsolved. Jurisdictional chaos often tied the hands of tribal police. If a non-Native person committed a crime on tribal land, local authorities might not have the power to charge them. They had to rely on federal prosecutors, who were already overwhelmed. And then there were the missing persons cases. No central database. No consistent protocols. Just gaps and grief. 1 year after Savannah's death, in a small community in Montana, a woman named Ashley Loring Heavy Runner disappeared. She was 20 years old, a college student, a proud member of the Blackfeet Nation. Her family begged for help. They printed flyers, knocked on doors, reported sightings. But law enforcement was slow. There was no Amber Alert, no search helicopters. Eventually, the media picked up the story, but only because of the parallels to Savannah. Another indigenous woman, another family in agony, another silence. The more people looked, the more they found. In Arizona, in South Dakota, in Oklahoma, names lost to statistics, families forgotten between arrests. Savannah's act had sparked hope, but it couldn't do everything. The law improved reporting protocols. It encouraged cooperation, but it didn't add investigators. It didn't eliminate jurisdictional complexity. It didn't restore trust. And trust was the rarest thing of all. Many Native families didn't trust police. They didn't believe help would come. For generations, it hadn't. The silence between the headlines wasn't just emotional, it was systemic. And it persisted long after the media moved on. Back in Fargo, Hazley Joe began to grow. She smiled early, walked at 10 months. Her laugh filled rooms. But every milestone came with a shadow. Her mother wasn't there to see her first steps, wasn't there to braid her hair or teach her songs from their Dakota heritage. The family tried to keep Savannah's presence alive. They told Hazley about her every day, showed her photos, played recordings of her voice, her favorite music. Ashton made a promise to raise his daughter with strength, truth, and love. But some nights, he still sat outside alone, staring at the moon, wondering what Savannah would say if she could see their daughter now. Outside their personal grief, the family remained advocates. They didn't want Savannah to be just another case that flared, then faded. They wanted her name to become a legacy. They spoke at universities, met with tribal councils, partnered with grassroots organizations that were pushing for a national inquiry into the MMIW crisis, missing and murdered indigenous women. It wasn't about fame. It was about the next girl. The one still missing. The one no one was looking for. The one whose name we may never know. In Washington, D.C., a mural of Savannah was painted on the wall of a community center near the National Museum of the American Indian. Her face looked out over Constitution Avenue, strong, soft, eternal. Visitors stopped to stare. Some cried. Others kept walking. But the mural stood unmoving. A silent monument to a mother taken too soon. A symbol for those still fighting. Savannah's story was not rare. What made it different was that we listened. But stories like hers still unfold every day. In rural towns. On reservations. In the spaces between federal law and local accountability. And the silence still grows. But now, there are more voices rising to break it. And behind every voice, there's a name. Savannah's was only the beginning. Chapter 5. The Woman Upstairs. Long before she became known as the Womb Raider, Brooke Cruz was just the woman upstairs. Neighbors described her as quiet, sometimes friendly, often withdrawn. She smiled in the hallway but didn't linger. There were arguments at night, shouting matches between her and William Hone that ended in slammed doors and silence. Nothing out of the ordinary. Just tension. Domestic friction. But inside apartment 7, something darker was brewing. Brooke Cruz, at 38 years old, was spiraling. Her relationship with William was volatile. She was unemployed, isolated, addicted to control but unable to grasp stability. In public, she appeared functional. In private, she was unraveling. What police would later uncover was a deeply disturbed woman, obsessive, manipulative, and dangerously unmoored from reality. Born in Texas, Brooke had a checkered past. She moved frequently. She left behind strained family relationships and a string of failed marriages. In her mid-30s, she relocated to Fargo in search of a fresh start. That's where she met William Hone, 13 years younger and with his own criminal record. Their connection was instant, toxic, and codependent. Friends say they fed off each other's instability. There were reports of domestic violence, both ways. At one point, Brooke was hospitalized for a suicide attempt. Another time, William called police on her, claiming she was destroying the apartment in a fit of rage. Still, they stayed together, bound not by love, but by dysfunction. And that dysfunction began to curdle into something much more dangerous. Brooke had long expressed a desire to have children. She told friends that becoming a mother would complete her, but she wasn't able to conceive. She spoke of fertility treatments that never happened. She hinted at miscarriages with no documentation. Those around her grew wary. Some thought she was lying for sympathy. Others believed she was delusional. Then, in early 2017, she began telling people she was pregnant. William later admitted he believed her. She told him she was due in late summer. She bought baby clothes, set up a crib. She even gained weight to keep up the lie. But there was no pregnancy, no doctor visits, no prenatal vitamins. There was only a growing obsession. And then came Savannah. The LaFontaine Graywines moved into the building in early 2017. Brooke noticed Savannah almost immediately. She was young, beautiful, radiating with the warmth of impending motherhood, and visibly pregnant. To Brooke, that belly was everything she thought she'd been denied. At first, she made small talk, comments in the hallway, compliments on Savannah's clothes. Innocent enough. But then she began asking questions. When are you due? Do you know if it's a boy or girl? Isn't it amazing, carrying a life like that? Savannah didn't think much of it. She was polite. She had no reason to fear the woman upstairs. But in Brooke's mind, a plan was forming. If she couldn't have a child, maybe she could take one. According to William, the plan was Brooke's idea alone. She began researching home births, black market adoption forums, surgical techniques. She searched for how to perform a C-section at home, and how long can a baby survive outside the womb. The day she lured Savannah to the apartment, everything was ready. The sewing project was a ruse, fabric cut in advance, scissors and pins arranged neatly. When Savannah entered the unit, Brooke struck her. It's unclear what she used, a hard object, possibly a glass vase. Savannah fell. Stunned. Confused. Brooke dragged her to the bathroom. Bound her wrists. And then she waited. According to her own confession, she didn't act immediately. She sat there, staring at Savannah, touching her belly. Savannah begged her to stop. She promised not to tell anyone. She told her about the baby. About Ashton. About the future. But Brooke didn't stop. She claimed William walked in and saw what she was doing. He turned away, didn't intervene, just walked out. That part is still disputed, but what happened next is not. Brooke performed the incision herself, with kitchen tools sterilized in boiling water. She didn't use anesthesia. She didn't use gloves. She cut into Savannah's abdomen and pulled the baby free. Savannah bled out within minutes, and Brooke wrapped the infant in towels, cleaned her, and cradled her like she was her own. In her interviews with police, Brooke spoke with eerie calm. She described each step without emotion, as if recounting a grocery list. "I just wanted a baby," she repeated. She talked about the days afterward like she was in a dream, feeding the newborn, singing to her, dressing her in tiny clothes. She even texted friends, claiming she delivered early. She named the child Phoenix, a twisted symbol of rebirth. The psychological profile compiled after her arrest described Brooke as narcissistic with delusional thinking. She had a long history of fabricating stories to manipulate others, but this was something more, a dangerous blend of psychosis and sociopathy. She didn't kill for pleasure. She didn't kill out of rage. She killed to complete a fantasy, to make her lie real. In court, her attorneys argued for leniency based on her mental state. They cited trauma, instability, untreated disorders. But the judge saw through it. Brooke had plotted, prepared, lured Savannah under false pretenses. It wasn't an impulsive act. It was premeditated, and it was cruel. To this day, Brooke Cruz remains incarcerated at the Dakota Women's Correctional Center. She has no access to children, no visitors from her past life. She has sent letters asking for forgiveness. The LaFontaine Grey Wines have never responded. Ashton once said in an interview, "She didn't just take Savannah from us. She tried to steal our daughter's life, too. She doesn't get forgiveness. She gets forgotten." Chapter 6, The Man Who Walked Away. William Hone sat in the interrogation room with his arms crossed and a blank stare. He didn't cry. He didn't ask for Savannah. He didn't even ask about the baby. Instead, he said what he thought would protect him. "I didn't kill her. I walked in and she was already dead." It was a defense that would echo throughout his trial. One that split a jury. One that made the public ask a darker question. How does a man help hide a murdered woman's body? Help clean the blood, conceal the baby, and still walk away without a murder conviction? The answer lies in the murky shadows between complicity and direct action. And William Hone knew how to walk that line. Born and raised in North Dakota, Hone had a troubled history. A criminal record with charges ranging from burglary to domestic assault. Multiple run-ins with law enforcement. He had bounced between jobs and relationships, rarely staying long in one place. When he met Brooke Cruz, he was in his mid-20s. She was 13 years older and immediately took control of the relationship. Friends said he became more volatile after moving in with her, more withdrawn, more reckless. Together, they created a toxic echo chamber. Brooke was manipulative. William was compliant. They fed each other's worst instincts. By 2017, the relationship had decayed into near-constant conflict. Police had been called to their apartment more than once. But like so many troubled couples, they always reconciled, always promised to start over. And then Savannah moved into the building. When investigators questioned William about the day of the murder, his version of events was carefully constructed. He said he returned home to find Brooke in the bathroom, covered in blood, holding a newborn baby. He claimed he was shocked, horrified. He said Brooke told him she'd just delivered the baby, implying it had been a medical emergency. He didn't believe her. Not really. But he didn't leave. Instead, he helped her clean up. He admitted to helping tie Savannah's ankles with rope. He admitted to wrapping her body in plastic and storing it in a dresser. He admitted to going with Brooke to dump the body into the Red River, weighted down with rocks. But he denied planning it, denied helping kill her. And that denial, as absurd as it seemed to many, was just enough to muddy the waters. In trial, his defense argued that William was a coward, not a killer. That he panicked and made terrible decisions, but did not commit murder. They described him as under Brooke's control. Manipulated. Abused. Passive. He didn't stab. He didn't cut. He didn't kill, the defense attorney said. He cleaned up a nightmare he walked into. The prosecution countered that argument with fury. If William Hone found Savannah dead, why didn't he call 911? The prosecutor asked. Why didn't he protect the baby? Why did he help wrap a human body like garbage and throw it in a river? Those questions haunted the jury. Jurors deliberated for 3 days. When the verdict was read, the room held its breath. Not guilty of conspiracy to commit murder. Guilty of kidnapping and providing false information. The courtroom exploded in stunned silence. Norberta wept. Ashton walked out before the sentence was even read. William Hone had escaped a murder charge, but he was sentenced to 20 years in prison for his role in the abduction and cover-up. It felt like a loophole in morality. He hadn't killed Savannah, but he didn't stop it either. And when faced with a choice between truth and survival, he chose silence. In a television interview months later, one juror explained their decision. "We didn't believe he was innocent, but we couldn't prove he planned it. And that's what murder requires, proof beyond doubt." It was the kind of legal outcome that makes the public lose faith. He helped restrain Savannah. He saw her blood. He saw her baby. And still, he didn't act. During his sentencing, William read a brief statement. "I didn't do enough. I'm sorry to Savannah's family. I was afraid. I failed." But the apology felt hollow. Mechanical. Like something his lawyer told him to say. Ashton later told a reporter, "If you can walk into a room, see the mother of your child's friend bleeding to death, and do nothing, you're not just guilty. You're broken." In 2021, William Hone filed a motion for sentence reduction. It was denied. The court ruled that the severity of his actions and the ongoing trauma to Savannah's family justified the full sentence. He remains incarcerated in a North Dakota state facility. He will be eligible for parole in 2037. By then, Hazley Joe will be 20 years old, the same age Savannah was when she first dreamed of becoming a mother. The question that lingers over William Hone is not whether he killed. It's whether doing nothing, watching, aiding, hiding, makes you just as guilty. In the eyes of the court, the answer was no. But in the hearts of Savannah's family, the answer will always be yes. Chapter 7, What Remains. The house is quiet when the morning sun filters in through the curtains. In the living room, a small girl with long black hair curls in her grandmother's lap, clutching a soft brown teddy bear. She's 5 now, bright-eyed, curious, fearless. Her name is Hazley Jo. She doesn't remember the nightmare she was born into. The first sounds she ever heard were not her mother's voice, but the sterile beeping of a hospital monitor. The arms that first held her were not Savannah's, but nurses, detectives, and eventually her father, Ashton, who never let her go again. What she knows today is love. Norberta and Ashton have made it their mission to raise her surrounded by truth, not shadows. She knows who her mother was. She knows what happened. But she also knows that she was wanted, that she was fought for, that her mother's love lived on through her. And sometimes that's enough. The pain never fully leaves. It's woven into everything. Birthdays, holidays, even quiet Sunday mornings. Sometimes Ashton hears laughter and swears it's Savannah's. Sometimes Norberta lights a candle before sunrise and whispers into the flame, hoping it reaches her daughter on the other side. They've both come to understand that grief isn't something you get over. It's something you carry, like a stone in your pocket. Heavy but familiar. But amid the ache, something else has grown. Purpose. Savannah's name now lives in legislation, murals, classrooms, and protest marches. Savannah's Act, passed in 2020, remains one of the few laws directly addressing the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. It has strengthened communication between tribal and federal authorities. It's helped streamline data systems. It's saved lives. But the real change is harder to measure. It's in the questions people ask now when an Indigenous girl goes missing. It's in the fire that ignites when justice lags. It's in the way women across Indian country now speak Savannah's name not with sorrow, but with strength. Each year on August 19th, a vigil is held in Fargo. People gather at the Red River, the same place Savannah was found. They light candles. They sing. They read the names of other missing women. And they speak directly to the girl who was stolen, but never silenced. Your life mattered. We see you. We won't forget. As the sun sets, hundreds of lights float down the river, illuminating the water with memory. One light for Savannah. One for every voice that was lost. One for every life that still remains. Hazley Jo, too young to understand the full weight of it, watches the lights drift downstream. She holds her grandmother's hand tightly. She doesn't cry. She just whispers, "That one's for Mommy." People often ask Ashton how he survived, how he moved forward after everything. He always gives the same answer. "I didn't. I changed." He's not the same man who paced hallways with panic in his chest. He's not the same boy who fell in love with Savannah at a powwow and imagined a simple life. He's something else now, sharper, slower, weathered by grief but anchored in love. And he sees himself in his daughter's eyes, not just as her protector, but as a living promise that her mother's story will never be erased. In 2025, a school in North Dakota announced the renaming of its community library, the Savannah LaFontaine Graywind Learning Center. It would house a collection of Indigenous literature, historical archives, and children's books focused on cultural pride. On the dedication day, Norberta stood on the small stage with Hazley beside her. They wore traditional Dakota ribbon skirts. The wind was warm. The audience was still. Norberta spoke softly. She was a daughter, a nurse, a dreamer, a mother. And now, she's part of something bigger. She turned to Hazley and smiled. "Your mommy made the world listen. What remains after unimaginable loss? A movement, a daughter, a legacy stronger than death."